Okay, ladies and gentlemen, once a year we have a session on religion and science, on Christianity and science and the relationship therein, and we're delighted to have as our final speaker Dr. Ted Davis, who many of you have been able to get to know while you're here. He's a professor of the history of science at Messiah College in Grantham, Pennsylvania. We need to remind everyone to turn off their cell phones, please. And so we're going to hear from Dr. Davis this morning on the Bible and biology. How did we get here? And then we'll have plenty of time for Q&A. And so about at this point, Dr. Davis, I'm going to ask, is this when you want the lights to go down?
Sure, yeah.
So with a person, someone please turn the lights down. And by the way, the people on the side, if you can't see the screen, you know, feel free to pick your chairs up and move to the back or wherever the best place is.
I just realized, Mike, that I'm not wired up.
You what?
I'm not wired up.
Uh-huh. Let me ask you about that.
Me sitting at a table talking to you is not conducive to a good experience.
Do we have a lavalier mic?
I'm a mobile lecturer.
I don't know if we have.
I didn't think to ask for a lapel mic. I should have. So
we might not have one. So we'll do our best.
Yeah.
Are those lights enough for you? Do you need the lights to go out any further?
Okay. That's up to you guys.
Do you need the lights to go out any further?
How dim do you want the lights to see that they see things like this and this? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Is that good? Okay.
Okay, thank you, Ted.
All right, well, thank you. Thank you, Michael. You have a printout that has most of my slides on it in the same form you'll see on the screen. There's a few additional slides I threw in this morning. Michael wanted me to make sure I did certain things to connect with your interests here, and I've been talking to a lot of you here, and I've added a few things for that reason. You can ask me anything you want at the end, and in the other two, you know, the two Q&A sessions, things that I don't touch on that you wish I had. And if I can't answer that, I'll just punt. So to start, here's what I want to try to accomplish. I want to answer three questions for you. Why has evolution been so controversial among American Christians? A variety of reasons for that. That's a historical question as well as a contemporary question. I think the reasons have not changed significantly since the time of the Scopes trial, as you'll see. Second, there's two very prominent forms of anti-evolutionism today. One of them is sometimes called scientific creationism or young earth creationism or just creationism without an adjective in front. The other is intelligent design, which its critics often call intelligent design creationism. I'm a dissenter on that tag. If you want to explore that with me more fully in the Q&A, I'll give you my reasons. What do these claim about God, the Bible, and evolution? And then the third question at the end, does the acceptance of evolution entail the denial of Orthodox Christianity? Now, here I'm using Orthodox Christianity with a small o. I don't mean specifically the Orthodox churches, that is, the churches of the East, the non-Roman forms of Christianity from the ancient world. I don't mean that. I mean, I'll define it for you clearly when we get to that point. What do I mean by Orthodox Christianity, small o? Let's start with perhaps the most famous trial of the 20th century. I still think that might be true in spite of other trials we've had subsequently. Certainly one of the most famous trials of the 20th century. The trial of John Scopes for teaching evolution in a public school in Tennessee in the spring of 1925, the summer. The trial followed that subsequent summer. I could say so much about this and not get past this slide and we'd be done, but then I wouldn't have answered any of the questions I put on the screen. Suffice it to say that this was a show trial. It was technically a criminal trial for a misdemeanor, for breaking an act that Tennessee had just enacted a few weeks earlier. It was an act that made it illegal for any public school teacher, which also meant, in context, public university teacher in Tennessee, to teach evolution or any theory which denies the biblical theory of creation. Words to that effect. Explicit reference to the Bible in the Act. As soon as that bill passed, the ACLU took out newspaper advertisements across the state of Tennessee, inviting challenges and offering to pay the expenses of any public school teacher who would deliberately break the law in order to put the law itself on trial. So the whole point was to put the law on trial, not to put an individual on trial. It was to get a criminal conviction and then take the law to higher courts for appeal to try to overturn the law. That's a short version of what took place. A substitute science teacher who normally didn't teach biology, substituting for the principal when he was ill, reviewed for the finals at the end of the year, perhaps used the E-word in class. They found students who could testify to that effect. Used the approved textbook in Tennessee, which is all about evolution. Had agreed to stand trial at the request of the school board, request of his boss, the head of the school board, in that district, who wanted to put the town of Dayton, Tennessee, on the map. So John Scopes, a rookie teacher, agreed to do that. He was charged with breaking the law. He simply, after he was told that he had broken the law, and thank you very much, he walked out of the conversation where that happened and went back to playing tennis with some of the boys at the school. That summer, the trial happened, and two people who weren't there in the beginning showed up on their own. First, for the prosecution to help uphold the law in Tennessee, William Jennings Bryan, whom we see on our right, who was a three-time unsuccessful candidate for president of the United States, the youngest candidate, in fact, in American history. He was 36 years old when he first ran for president in 1896. He was a very liberal Democrat. If you've read the article that was in your packet, you can see the kinds of things he supported. I will skip that. And then on the left, Clarence Darrow, arguably the greatest trial lawyer of the 20th century, shows up in court because Brian's already there. Brian has gone there, volunteered his services to the prosecution because he was asked to do so by someone called William Bell Riley, who was the first president of the World Christian Fundamentals Association, which was founded right after World War I. Brian had been crusading for anti-evolution laws across the country starting in 1922. Tennessee had taken the bait on that, had passed a law that was then broken and enforced. So that's what led to all this. But when Darrow learned that Brian was going to be there, he jumped at this. Darrow was an agnostic by his own religious admissions. That's what he tells people in correspondence. He was an agnostic. He was seen publicly as an atheist, and that's because he was an anti-religious person. He loved to debate Christians in public settings about, for example, the reliability of the Bible, such things as was Jonah really swallowed by a whale, as Darrow puts it? And Brian, in fact, when he and Darrow go at this in the Scopes trial, in a famous scene, when Brian himself is cross-examined by Darrow on the Bible, Brian points out it's a big fish, and they get into arguments about things like this. That's all famous. You can read about that in Ed Larson's Pulitzer Prize-winning book on the Scopes trial called Summer for the Gods. And if I can digress for a second, I'm going to pass this around while I'm talking. If you want information, reliable information, about the legal history of creationism, this is the best source. This is another book by Ed Larson. This is called Trial and Error. This is the third edition, updated to include the Kitzmiller v. Dover trial. It's on the American controversy over creation and evolution. That's a wonderful source. Larson is an attorney and a professor of law at Pepperdine. He's also a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian trained in my field, history of science. You had him here, great. So that's a great resource. I'll just put it on your radar screens. So Darrow has this reputation of being the village atheist, and he's showing up here in order to get opportunities to have a public platform from which, through the press, to debate William Jennings Bryan and about issues about the Bible and Christianity. He offers his support to John Scopes, goes directly to the defendant. The defendant says, yes, I'd like you to be my lead attorney. even though the ACLU already has a team on site. They don't want Darrow in this, but Darrow comes in and Scopes accepts him. Darrow pays his own expenses, and he takes this opportunity to market his ideas in this way. Now, why did Brian get involved in a crusade? Why did he really effectively start a political crusade to try to outlaw the teaching of evolution in publicly funded schools? Private schools could do whatever they want. Well, he had never been a proponent of evolution. Going back into his history, he always saw evolution as what he called the law of hate, the law by which the strong crowd out and kill off the weak. He's referring to the popularly worded definition of Darwinian evolution, which was survival of the fittest, a term that Charles Darwin himself did not use in the first edition of The Origin of Species, but used in some later editions after Herbert Spencer, the famous social philosopher, had described Darwin's theory as survival of the fittest. Brian's opposition to monopolistic capitalism, which was rampant at the turn of the century, was one of the reasons he opposed evolution. He saw it, it's kind of ironic, isn't it, that forms of social Darwinism in the late 19th century, including rampant American capitalism, was itself justified in the eyes of the proponents by Darwin's theory of evolution. And yet, of course, Darwin's theory of evolution, in turn, had come out of what would have been called at the time liberal economics in the 19th century, that is, free market economics, the economics specifically of Malthus and of Adam Smith. That those are the intellectual currents underlying evolution by natural selection. I won't say more about that. You can go after that in the Q&A if you would like. But for now, the full circle has come full circle. So these ideas expressed in Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection are seen in Germany before World War I as justification for the German military dominance of Europe. Now, the reason these ideas reach America through a leading American biologist at the time, Vernon Kellogg, who's a professor at Stanford, and he is a pacifist. And during World War I, before the United States gets involved, Kellogg goes over to Belgium to help in the relief efforts for the civilian population there. He's actually assisting his former student, Herbert Hoover, who is setting this up in Europe. This is before the United States becomes a combatant nation. Recall, World War I begins in the summer of 1914, and the United States doesn't get involved until the spring of 1917, during which time, in fact, William Jennings Bryan is Secretary of State. And then he pulls out of Woodrow Wilson's government because he believes Wilson is duplicitously leading America into war. And at that point, Bryan is probably a pacifist himself. Indeed, he and Darrow both wrote pacifist tracts during World War I for the same collection of writings. And politically, Darrow and Bryan were very much on the same page for much of their lives. In fact, Darrow ran for Congress in 1896 in Chicago on the same ticket that Bryan is heading at the federal level, and they both get defeated. In any case, back to Kellogg. Kellogg writes about his experiences in Belgium, specifically his conversations he has with German officers at the headquarters of the German command in that part of Belgium. He turns out he is billeted in a building where he has frequent conversations with German officers. Kellogg, like many other American scientists of that generation, got his doctoral work done in Germany, so he's fluent in German. He has conversations with these officers, and then he comes back to America and writes about it in this book published by the Atlantic Monthly Press with a preface by Theodore Roosevelt. In this book, he relates that German officers have led him to, some of whom were university professors before the war, give him the impression that what he calls the gospel of an Allmacht, an omnipotence of natural selection, is really important in the German intelligentsia. And in their minds, it gives them justification for dominating the rest of Europe militarily as a necessary consequence of natural law. That's his view. That's the view he expresses, a view that horrifies Kellogg. But this is what he's hearing, and this is what he tells the American people he's hearing about Germany. Brian reads this book, and he is shocked, too. And this is one of the reasons why, after World War I, he decides to try to... It's time now to ban the teaching of evolution in American schools. This is also the first time that most Americans are going through public high school. And so they're seeing evolution for the first time and bringing it back to their families. So in 1922, William Jennings Bryan travels the country trying to persuade state legislatures to ban the teaching of evolution in publicly funded schools. Fundamentalists, who are only just appearing on the landscape by that name at this time, I'll come back to that, are really excited by this. And the leading fundamentalist cartoonist of the day, Ernest James Pace, who had been a former political cartoonist in Chicago before his conversion to fundamentalist Christianity, cartoons Bryan and his ideas in very favorable ways, often. This particular cartoon shows us a lot. Notice the reference to the Battle of Verdun, and the iconography shows Bryan as the hero of Verdun with the banner, the French battle cry from that battle. Verdun, of course, had been one of the great battles of World War I. It was a fortified French town, many, many forts around it. Multiple armies, I mean multiple German armies, you know, army groups and multiple French army groups, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of men, I don't recall the right number, were fighting for a long time at Verdun, as they often were in World War I conflicts. His fundamentalist followers are behind him, and of course, outside the ramparts are the enemies of the Bible, and the enemies of the Bible, by implication of this iconography, are who? Well, the Germans, of course. There was a profound anti-German feeling in the United States after World War I. Germany was not only linked with Darwinian evolution in a social Darwinian way, as I've already indicated, but Germany was also the source of modern biblical scholarship. And that's another reason why Germany is seen as the land of infidelity on the part of American fundamentalists after World War I. Now, how fundamentalists themselves see their own situation is illustrated by this cartoon from the leading fundamentalist periodical, or a leading fundamentalist periodical of the time. This comes from something called The King's Business, which was published out of the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, which is now BIOLA, Biola University. It used to be in downtown LA. It's now in suburban La Mirada. The dean of the faculty at Biola in the 20s was a leading fundamentalist biblical scholar and theologian named Reuben Torrey. He had been the third and final editor of a series of pamphlets published shortly before the war called The Fundamentals, which were defending traditional Christianity against very liberal Christians who had already identified themselves as modernists. That was modernist and fundamentalist were self-chosen labels from the period, in the same way in which pro-choice and pro-life are self-chosen labels of a controversy going on right now. Opponents might have had other terms for people, but they were the terms that the proponents themselves chose. This cartoon shows the battleships of modernity bombarding the Bible. And these battleships are labeled culture, liberal theology, modern thought, science, hypothesis, you'll see why hypothesis shortly, and atheism. And they're bombarding a Bible, which of course is like the Rock of Gibraltar, is not going down, but it's an intense controversy. This is a concert, this is a context, in other words, of culture wars, no less than today. There was a great culture war going on in the 1920s, and American Protestants were caught up in it. Bryan and other self-labeled fundamentalists saw evolution as just one of several aspects of modernity that's attacking the Bible. Now, the word fundamentalist itself comes in this context. Verbally, as you'll see in the quotation I'm going to show you in a minute, verbally there is some suggestion that it may have been in use prior to its first use in print. Historians have not found an earlier reference to the word than from a Baptist magazine in July of 1920. So the word fundamentalist originates in an American context, in a Protestant context, at this time. Despite its later use in many ways, even the late Stephen Jay Gould used to describe some of his scientific colleagues as scientific fundamentalists for their attitude toward religion. And of course, it's been used in an Islamic, I'm reporting on Islamic context for a while as well. But it originates in this context, And the Baptist editor of a magazine called The Watchman Examiner has just returned from a convention where he's been talking with friends who are concerned about liberal tendencies in the denomination. And they've agreed that they need to start identifying themselves as a group in certain ways. They're looking for a name. And he himself, he says, speaking of himself, we suggest that those who still cling to the great fundamentals, he means traditional Christian doctrine, and who mean to do battle royal for the fundamentals, shall be called fundamentalists. This is how the word is used in that sense. The leading historian of fundamentalism, George Marsden, has emphasized this aspect of the definition, I think properly, the militant anti-modernism as the essence of the attitude of fundamentalists. And you can see that in the viewpoints they took toward evolution. So this movement has been in existence, really. It's been growing since the late 19th century, but it self-identifies as fundamentalists under that label in the decade of the 1920s. And that, of course, is the decade in which the Scopes trial takes place. Now, what about evolution? What are the problems that Christians had with evolution then and that many still have now? Well, one of them is the view that evolution is simply a hypothesis, meaning an unwarranted guess, a wild guess that it is not supported by the facts. Scientists use the word hypothesis in a different sense, as a possible truth for which evidence will be gathered over time in an effort to show that beyond a reasonable doubt, we should believe it. Whereas Brian and fundamentalists use it in the sense of something you thought of last night. And it's shown in this cartoon by Pace as a hypothesis in that sense, the hard Darwinian hypothesis of evolution. It's falling out of the clouds of speculation. It's full of hot air, in fact. And it's heading toward the facts, a collision with the facts. The gondola of the balloon is labeled science falsely so-called. I'm going to come back to that. So the fundamentalists see this as unsupported speculation about to collide with facts. Now, this gondola, labeled science falsely so-called, this term has a long history. If you're interested in that, you can ask me about it later. I've written an article about that that I don't want to go into here. But evolution is an example in their view of science falsely so-called. The phrase science falsely so-called comes from the King James Version of the Bible, Paul's letter to Timothy, chapter 6, verse 20. In context, it says he advises Timothy to avoid vain babblings and science falsely so-called. The Greek word used there is the word gnosis, meaning knowledge. Knowledge really is, in the ancient world, the closest word equivalent to our modern term philosophy, maybe, or knowledge, whereas not more narrowly to natural science. But science is a fair translation because the word science historically has had very broad meaning. It's only in the last couple of centuries it's usually taken a more narrow meaning to mean natural science. So there you have it, science falsely so-called. That's what James's translators thought in the early 17th century was the best English word to use. Now, the idea that this is false science, is crucial for understanding fundamentalist responses. Now, here's a British cartoon. You know, the Brits don't get off scot-free here. This particular cartoon comes from a London journalist in the 1930s named Newman Watts, who wrote a little book called Why Be an Ape that includes interesting cartoons drawn by a person we have never identified as historians. But this particular cartoon, or at least this historian doesn't know who it was, perhaps someone else does. The word hypothesis is a synonym used by scientists for the word guess, says William Jennings Bryan. That's his understanding of a hypothesis, his guess. And evolution is not truth. He says it's merely a hypothesis. It's millions of guesses strung together. So hence this slide. Millions of guesses strung together. These are all guesses about the past that no one can demonstrate, and we end up with humans being evolved from apes at the top. That comes from Brian's last statement at Dayton, which he was going to read as his final argument in court, but final arguments were done away with by the judge, so he read it to journalists outside as his final speech. He died just a few days later. On the education side, from this cartoon of Pace, you can see how evolution was seen as headed toward infidelity and being driven there by educational authorities like professors. I forgot my mortarboard on the way here. I'm sorry. And It's being blown toward the rocks by the God-denying theory of evolution, as the Bible is being thrown overboard at the instruction of the professor. Many Christians, then and now, see evolution as a God-denying theory that contradicts the Bible, and therefore not religiously neutral and inappropriate for public education. You know, the view that public education should avoid sectarian religion goes back to the founding of public education in the United States. And for a while, that worked well. But this is the first time I can think of that a really controversial subject in a religious way is coming into public schools is in the early 20th century. It does, for many Americans, seem to violate that understanding of what public education is supposed to be about. And they see this as, Brian sees this, and others see it at the time as a violation of the constitutional mandate for religious neutrality on the part of the government. This image shows the intensity of the feeling on the part of fundamentalists about evolution, which is evolution here is shown as the Pied Piper taking American children toward death. Notice that the cave is shaped like a skull with disbelief in the God of the Bible. And they're following the rats along the path of education, being blown there by the hypothesis of evolution. And this guy is science falsely so-called, in case we didn't see that. So that is how they see this. American school children are being led to their spiritual death by the teaching of a hypothesis that violates, that's not true, it's not true, it's a false idea, and it's not religiously neutral. In fact, this young woman at university has to exchange her faith, which is more precious than gold, for a diploma, which is science falsely so-called. And as one of my students noticed, and I had not noticed until one day I was showing it in class, and she pointed out to me, that's a pistol. That's a pistol which is aimed at her head in exactly the same way in which, of course, back in the era of Bonnie and Clyde and others, you have highway robbery going on. So this college professor is extorting her faith from her in exchange for her diploma. And she's picking up false science in the process. Now, these kinds of concerns are no less today than they were then. This is a book that is very influential on current American fundamentalist thinking about science. It's called The Lie, subtitle Evolution, written by Ken Ham. I'll tell you more about Ken Ham in just a minute. Ken Ham wrote this book in the 1980s, and it has his attitude is displayed very well in the book. His ministry, Answers in Genesis, is probably the leading creationist website today. But unlike Brian, who had no problem with the Earth's great age, the Earth's age being millions of years old, or today we would say billions of years old, Brian had no problem with that view. Ken Ham thinks that view itself is part of the problem, the view that the Earth is really old. And Ham rejects not only evolution, but also the age of the Earth. This makes him far more reactionary toward science than Brian even had been. Here's a cartoon from Ken Ham's organization that shows where they're coming from and emphasizes, indeed, the young Earth piece. There are earlier forms of this cartoon that have a different wording on the foundation of the humanism castle that do not make reference to millions of years. They make reference simply to evolution. But current versions of this cartoon, which has undergone an evolution, you might say, do show, indeed, changes in the emphasis of young Earth organizations. Culture wars are still part of the context today. Indeed, this is very similar, isn't it, in its spirit to what you saw with the dueling, the battleships against the Rock of Gibraltar from the 20s. An addition from then would be also emphasis on the consequences of believing that the Earth is old. That's what this cartoon is about, the fatal spiritual consequences of accepting an old universe and an old Earth. Because if you do that, in the opinion of Answers in Genesis, you're taking man's authority over the authority of the Bible. Whereas Christianity, the castle of Christianity, is based on the assumption that 6 days equals God's authority. Say, earlier versions of this cartoon don't have that specific point, but this current version does. It's current, even though it's from 2002, it still looks like this. 6 days equal God as authority. The humanism people who are associated with evolution are actually bombarding the right place, the roots of Christianity, by attacking the age of the earth issue. Whereas the Christians are clueless. This guy is firing at these balloons, these social consequences of humanism, and this guy's firing in the wrong direction. This guy's about to fire at another Christian, and this guy is firing at his own foundation. So this is how they see things as an embattled group in today's culture war. Indeed, Ham and other fundamentalists see evolution as actually satanic in origin. Earlier versions of this cartoon have Satan as the origin of this view on the left, and God as the origin of this view on the right. And they think it's inseparable from these various social consequences. Now, what about the two current forms of these ideas that are the most common to encounter in the news? Scientific creationism, which is this young Earth creationist stuff of Ken Ham. The term scientific creationism is older than Webster's online dictionary will tell you. It goes back at least to the early 1970s. And on the right, Evolution Wars. Is the author of that article in the room?
No.
No? This occurred during the run-up, I think, to the Kitzmiller-Dover trial a few years ago. Okay. Afterward, if you want, you can ask me about my experiences at the Kitzmiller v. Dover trial. A lot of the reporters were asking me stuff afterwards because the stuff that was happening in the courtroom was basically, a lot of it was history and philosophy of science. And other than the actual people in the witness stand, I was the other person in the room who knew what was going on with all of that. And so it was very interesting. I won't come back to that in the session. Ken Ham is an Australian by birth, former science teacher, who has been in the United States for a long time. He is in charge of Answers in Genesis, this organization, which has the famous Creation Museum in northern Kentucky. Here's Ken with one of his friends from the museum. This photograph from their own site makes a point that I want to make, namely that in Ham's view, dinosaurs and human beings coexisted for a long time after the creation until sometime after the flood. That's not true in mainstream science, although there are a few creatures from that period who are still around with us, like crocodiles and a coelacanth in the ocean. Nearly all of the animals and plants from those periods when the dinosaurs flourished have been long gone from the earth. Now, the website Answers in Genesis is perhaps the best place to go to see what creationists themselves think of a topic. It even has a search engine on its own site where you can go and plug it in. I chose this particular version of their homepage from not too many years ago to use because it emphasizes the same idea Brian was emphasizing, that evolution isn't even a theory. It's just a wild guess. Now, a central tenet of creationism is that the place you want to go to get information about the formation of the earth and living things is here. You want to go to the Bible. And the reason is straightforward. Namely, the Bible was directly spoken by God to human authors who record it, or human scribes, essentially, who record it. And therefore, this is eyewitness testimony of the creation. And you can't get higher than that. Whatever speculation science may have must be subordinated to the direct testimony of the only person who witnessed it, the divine person. And since God has told us directly what took place, how can you have a higher authority? That's evident in this cartoon from the person who's probably the leading contemporary creationist cartoonist, Don Letha. And you see how God has painted this scene in 6 days, and that is the best evidence for the amount of time used for the creation is the testimony of one who made it. And the best evidence for a young earth, these are where you find it, according to creation scientists. No, it's not any of these. That's the best. So creationist arguments that arise out of science, out of their interpretation of science, aren't even as good as the Bible itself. The Bible is the evidence you want. It's the ultimate authority. Now, the book you're looking at here illustrating this next point is The Bible of Young Earth Creationism. speaking of the Bible. This was published in 1961 by two people I will tell you about shortly, John Whitcomb and Henry Morris. A second central point would be that they would show in their book is that scientific evidence, when properly interpreted, is consistent with the literal interpretation of the Bible. But it's mainly the historical sciences are the ones which are contested territory, if you will. The historical sciences refer to the sciences that tell us about the past of the earth, like cosmology or evolutionary biology or paleontology or geology. Areas like anatomy, physiology, atomic theory, or nuclear fission, these kinds of things are not contested territory for the creationists. No issues there with that. That's all current science. You can verify that fully. And it doesn't impinge on the biblical story of creation. It's all fine. But it's these areas where people heavily contest scientific claims. According to creationists, humans and dinosaurs are created on the same day, as I've indicated, the sixth day of creation, and they coexisted with us for some time after, until after, sometime after the flood. How old? How old is the earth on creationist views? Not more than somewhere from 6,000 to 12,000 years. I won't tell you how they get that number. If you want to ask me afterward, I can give you ideas about that. But it does contrast greatly with mainstream scientific ideas. Many of you probably have a sense of how old science thinks things are. Pretty current numbers for the Earth itself would be this number, 4.5 billion years. That's what BY means. And the universe, nearly 14 billion years old. Billion years. Order of magnitude matters. I mean, if you won the lottery and it was $10,000, it wouldn't change your life. You win the lottery at $4.5 billion, it does. You get the idea. The order of magnitude is what matters here. I'll skip my comments on the Big Bang and move to one other point. Creationists do see alternative interpretations of the Bible as really heretical and even harmful to Christianity. The word compromise is used as a pejorative in this conversation, and that's not going to surprise anyone who reports about modern political events. But the word compromise is used as a dangerous term. Accommodation. And I will have to say something about this. A final piece, the flood described in Genesis on the creationist view produced at least a lot of the fossils on the earth. And of course, the flood happened during human history. And this view that the flood had produced these fossils rather than the ages of the earth and all the processes producing fossils, that view is called flood geology, and it does contradict natural history since the early 19th century. Okay, now, from the mid-19th century through the mid-20th century, for roughly 100 years, most conservative Protestant writers in this country held to old earth versions of creationism, not young earth versions. I won't detail those two. I want to illustrate the point by saying that the most widely used Bible among conservative Protestants in England and America in this period, including Pentecostals, was the Scofield Reference Bible, published in the early 20th century by Oxford University Press. It has extensive footnotes in it that specifically endorse old earth versions of interpreting Genesis. In fact, William Bell Riley, the man that sent Brian to Dayton, Tennessee, who's in contact with fundamentalists across the entire country, in a better position, in my view, to say this than anyone else. He's on the top of the sort of fundamentalist pyramid. In a debate he has with an atheist in Arkansas in 1920s, he says he cannot identify a single intelligent fundamentalist who claims that the earth is made 6,000 years ago, and the Bible never taught any such thing, says Riley. This has completely changed since the 1920s. During that period I showed you, belief in a young earth and flood geology was prominent only among certain fringe groups in Protestantism, such as the Seventh-day Adventists, who follow their prophet, 19th century prophet Ellen White, in her teachings on these issues, about which I'll spell out for you in a moment. I'm just going to add the point that Dr. Benjamin Carson is probably the most well-known Adventist today. I am not trying to say that the views of Ellen White are necessarily his. You'd have to ask him personally about those views. I don't know Dr. Carson. I don't know whether he would agree with White on everything I'm going to tell you next. But this is what his tradition has held, and in many cases, people still would hold these within the Adventist tradition. Notice how you spell it, by the way. Editors often get this wrong. This is spelled correctly, the capitalization and hyphenization, et cetera. And the correct pronunciation is Adventist, emphasis on the first syllable, not Adventist, as many other Christians will often say. White claimed to have these trance-like visions in which God had revealed truth to her. And in one of them, about the creation week, she says she was carried back to the creation and was shown that the first week, in which God performed the work of creation in 6 days and rested on the seventh day, was like just like every other week. You see the connection with Seventh-day Adventist teaching, with religious teaching, which I'll tell you about in a minute. She also taught that Noah's flood had, in fact, sculpted the surface of the earth and produced fossils. And that flood geology, as it's later called, is a standard part of Adventist teaching. Another standard part of Adventist teaching is that other Christians who worship God on Sunday are Sabbath breakers and therefore heretics. So we should worship God on the Jewish Sabbath, the seventh day. That's when God actually rested, not on Sunday, the day on which Christ was raised from the grave, to remind us that creation week was literal and that God actually rested on the seventh day. I'm going to skip George Price, that piece. It's an important piece of history, but I'm running out of time. The ideas of George Price, a Canadian disciple of White, are picked up on by Henry Morris and John Whitcomb, two fundamentalist Americans, in the early 60s. And they write about these ideas without much reference, with minimal reference to Price, but the ideas all come from Price, in the book The Genesis Flood, published in 1961. Now, intelligent design, I don't have a lot to say about that. I know I don't have much time. But Philip Johnson is basically the author of the intelligent design movement, which comes much later in the 20th century. It really emerges strong in public display in the 1990s. It has its roots in the 1980s. Philip Johnson is still living. He's no longer in very good health, but he is a retired professor of law from University of California, Berkeley. And in the 1960s, as a young law graduate, having attended Harvard and Chicago, undergraduate and graduate school, becomes clerk for Chief Justice Earl Warren. You all know what that means and its significance. He has a conversion to Christianity as a mature law professor after he's gone through a divorce, and he is suddenly motivated to start writing against the kinds of atheism he finds in Richard Dawkins in works like The Blind Watchmaker, which he encounters while he's on sabbatical in England. And he, to make a long story short, his intellectual disciples today have various locations, but the primary location would be an arm of the Discovery Institute in Seattle, which has its own website with search engine as well, where you can learn all about that from their own perspective, if you want to. Now, concerning the Bible now, surprisingly, the Bible's not part of this conversation for them in a direct way. Not at all. They want to leave out the word God, they want to leave out theology, they want to leave the Bible out of the picture as well. And why that is because they want to change the way science is taught in high school. And for constitutional reasons, they leave it out. So you're all familiar with First Amendment stuff. I can come back to that in creationism, law, and the law if you want me to later. But, this is an idea that's organized and directed by a law professor. And Johnson has even himself said that the first thing you have to do is get the Bible out of the conversation. So this is a very different tone in that regard than creationism of a classical variety. I'll skip these slides on what it's about, but the biblical issues and the theological issues that creationists dispute, that can all come later if you want, but that's not part of ID. ID is simply the secular notion that you need to challenge the secular establishment on thinking that naturalistic evolution has done everything. It's really an opposition to evolution in a naturalistic form, or what they will often call Darwinism, using that term. That term has a long history, too, that I will leave out. It's hard to separate from culture wars, but I need to move on. Finally, the question, does evolution deny Orthodox Christianity? I need to define Orthodox in this context, and I will in just a second with another image. William Jennings Bryan thought the answer was very clearly yes. evolution does deny Orthodox Christianity. This cartoon, another Pace cartoon from Brian's day, shows rationalism pounding the wedge of theistic evolution, which is the idea that God used evolution to create organisms. This term and idea go back almost to Darwin's day, but in the 1920s, it's in common parlance, and it's splitting faith in the Bible. Brian described theistic evolution in this language. Theistic evolution was an anesthetic that deadens the pain, while the patient's religion is being gradually removed. Remember, Brian was regarded in the 1920s as the leading political orator in the United States. He was a very gifted orator. Darrow didn't want to have to face off with him in final arguments. The great defense attorney thought he might actually lose in the opinion world to this great political orator. And it was, Brian also said it was a way station, theistic evolution, a way station on the highway that leads from Christian faith to no God land. And this is what he meant. This is a cartoon which you'll see on the internet dated to 1922. That's wrong. It's from 1924. The cartoon Brian writes, designing this cartoon, is written in January of 1924 to the editor of a Sunday school magazine called the Sunday School Times. Brian says it will depict evolution as what we know it to be, meaning he and the editor, namely the cause of modernism in religion. And he says it will depict a student stepping from going down a staircase on which there is no stopping place, i.e. a slippery slope, and the student is stepping from Bible not infallible to man not made in God's image. Halfway down, a minister with a Bible in his hands, stepping from no deity, meaning no deity of Jesus, to no atonement. And at the bottom, a scientist stepping from agnosticism to atheism. This is Pace's version of that letter that Brian wrote. I'll skip that. Today, what's changed? One thing that's changed is the presence of a fairly sizable group of scientists and science journalists, even in some cases, writing aggressively anti-religious books, like Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. You may be familiar with Dawkins' work. A second example is within liberal Christianity. Many theologians today would hold a view similar to John Shelby Spong, reformer bishop of Newark, Episcopal bishop of Newark, who thinks you need to give up theism in Christianity. Why Christianity must change or die. But a third alternative, the one that I want to end with, is the view represented by some leading Christian theologians and scientists whose views were not present in the earlier conversation in the 1920s. Views like theirs were not there. Namely, that traditional Christian belief, the kinds of beliefs Brian was afraid people were giving up because of evolution, can be maintained consistently side by side with a full acceptance of evolution. Francis Collins, the geneticist, is prominent for this. You probably all know who he is. You may not know who John Polkinghorne is. He was a leading particle physicist from England who has a very wide American readership. He's a fellow of the Royal Society. He was involved in the mathematics of quark theory in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s until he became an Anglican priest. And he is, the last 30 years, he's written many books about science and faith, including a commentary on the Nicene Creed, which is a classical Christian statement of faith from Princeton University Press called The Faith of a Physicist. Or someone like Robert John Russell, who in my opinion is the leading Christian theologian dealing with science. He's also a trained physicist. He writes at the Center for Theology and Natural Sciences in Berkeley. He is Orthodox small o Christian and a full evolutionist. Or someone like Owen Gingerich, retired professor of astronomy and history of science at Harvard, whose recent books are a series of things he's given as lectures in Harvard Chapel and other places. His two most recent are God's Universe and God's Planet. God's Planet's just off the press this past year. And these are all defenses of Orthodox Christianity to some extent. They mainly talk about the science itself, but they can talk about Orthodox Christianity side by side with that. But for many Americans, the ideas of people like this are just not acceptable. They're not acceptable any more than those of Dawkins would be acceptable. But I do think historically they represent a significant new feature on the landscape. World-class scientists and theologians who accept evolution, but who also affirm the incarnation, classical Christian view of the deity of Jesus, and the bodily resurrection of Jesus. And there wasn't anybody out there like them in the 1920s. I've been looking for those people in my historical work for the last 15 years. They probably existed, but they're very hard to find today. They weren't big public voices in the 20s. Will these voices have a permanent effect on the conversation? That's a good question. You know, will this lead somewhere else? I'm afraid I have to say the same thing Professor Robiteau said yesterday. I'm a historian, I'm not a prophet, and I really don't know how this is going to play out. But I do think it's not the same as the 1920s, and that could perhaps prove to be significant.